This podcast is sponsored by ebookit.com, self-publishing solutions for the independent author and small press. Visit us today at ebookit.com.
Welcome to the Toastmasters Podcast, the official podcast of Toastmasters International. Hello, everybody. This is Greg Gazin.
And I'm Ryan Levesque.
Ryan, it's been about a month since the Toastmasters convention, and one of the main events is the World Championship of Public Speaking. And of course, this year is no different. We crowned a new world champion. Ryan, who are we speaking with today?
Verity Price is our guest today. She's a professional speaker, facilitator, and distinguished Toastmaster from Cape Town, South Africa. And of course, as you just said, Greg, as of August 28th, she is now the 2021 world champion of public speaking. She is the first ever African to earn the title and the sixth woman to win the title in 80 years. Congratulations, Verity Price, and welcome to the Toastmasters podcast.
Welcome.
Thank you so much, and how lovely to be here.
Verity, I'm sure it's been a whirlwind since the international convention. Of course, you're the world champion, first from Africa, sixth woman in the world, and I'm sure you're getting lots of media attention. Just wondering, how does it feel right now? What's life been like for you in the past month?
Whew. It's been intense, Greg. I'm not going to lie. It's been amazing. The attention and the excitement about the win has been fantastic, especially in South Africa and Southern Africa. It just means so much to the Toastmasters here that someone has finally brought the title home. So everyone is getting excited to try do it again next year.
Awesome.
Verity, of course, there's a big difference between hearing about a speech and actually hearing the speech and watching it. Nevertheless, for our listeners who haven't yet had the pleasure of watching your winning speech, can you bring them up to speed and give a sense of what your talk was about?
Absolutely. So my winning speech was called A Great Read, and it was a very honest look into what my life looked like at 40, very different to the dream life I'd had. I was single, I was childless, I was living in my sister's spare room, and I was in a pretty dark place. And that it took finding a letter from my late father to remind me that I had a choice, and that if I didn't like the way I looked, my life was looking, I needed to write a different story. And that I started doing that, inspired by his example, to have a positive attitude about difficult situations, and that it turned my life around. And I moved to a new home, I met my husband, I had a child, and it really was a speech that I hoped would inspire anyone in a difficult place to know that by writing a different story, they can change the narrative of their life.
Wow.
Not just those in a difficult place. I think it was inspiring for anyone who heard it, just to be reminded about the fact that we have way more control than I think a lot of times we give ourselves credit for. But I'd like to touch back. You mentioned your father, and it really sounded like he had an uncommon optimism. I wonder, where do you think that came from?
He really did have an incredible ability to be positive in difficult situations. And I think it came from the fact that he was born 12 weeks premature in 1928. He was a twin. His sister, who was the stronger one, actually passed away at 9 days. And my father, who weighed 800 grams or was the size of a block of butter, survived with no incubators in the middle of winter in Zimbabwe on a farm. And so he grew up with quite a weak body and a weak heart. But I think that helped him to develop a strong mind and an incredible attitude. And I often, when I looked at the way he lived his life, I think it all came out of the fact that things hadn't come easy to him. So he'd learned to look at life in a new way and make it work to his advantage.
Well, thinking things weren't easy, that's an understatement. Wow, he certainly he certainly endured a lot. Now, I read somewhere, I can't recall if it was during one of your interviews or it was an article that I read, that your message changed from the original message. And so I'm curious as to what was the theme originally? And I also understand that it was feedback that you got that sort of caused the change. Maybe just share a little bit about that.
Yeah, absolutely. The first version of the speech was the same story, But what happened after getting my dad's letter in reality was I was on Facebook and I was comparing myself to everyone. And then I found a challenge called the 100 Happy Days Challenge, which says take a picture of one thing a day that makes you happy and share it. And that was one of the things I started doing to develop a better attitude. But when I did that as a speech, I was talking about 100 happy days and happy pictures and feeling happy. I started getting feedback from, first of all, my brother-in-law, who'd put up with me in the spare room already, saying, if you have to keep going on about happiness, I'm going to get sick. It's too fluffy. And I was like, what? This is such a great speech. It's going to inspire people to take happy pictures. And he just said, you've lost me. And I'm so glad I listened to that. And I looked at the speech going, yes, I did do a 100 happy days challenge, but if I take it out, does the speech lose the strength of the message? And it didn't. In fact, it simplified the way I could relay the choices I made to look at my life differently. But it took me a good 5 weeks to find that new way of relaying it. So the feedback was crucial.
It seems sometimes when we have our choice stories or select words, that it's the hardest thing to do is to eliminate them.
Yes, and let it go.
Staying on the theme of feedback, Verity, I also understand that one of the things that you did when you got feedback is you intentionally got global feedback. How did that affect how you made changes to your speech?
So it was incredible that in this virtual environment, I was able to speak at over 40 clubs on 5 continents and receive feedback from diverse audiences. So it helped me with some simple things around language, especially actually for a more American or Western audience. Initially, I was saying we lived in a caravan after my dad lost his job. And then when I spoke in America, they said, oh, you might need to say camper van so people know what that means. And that was really useful feedback. There was a lot around language and terminology that I was able to change. Through speaking around the world, I also could hear if people felt excluded from my speech. Someone mentioned that they saw a lot of hope in my speech, but they were much older than 40, and what about them? And then that prompted me to mention that my dad was 60 when he lost his job, and saying it doesn't matter who you are or where you are, you can always change your story. So it was receiving feedback from people, letting me know where the gaps were in my speech, that helped me to fill those gaps and close the gaps between me and the audience.
The ability to get feedback from around the world like that is something that wasn't available to Toastmasters just a couple of years ago, at least not as easily as it is today. And that brings up the virtual nature of the contest. This is our second ever virtual international speech contest. Verity, last year's winner, Mike Carr, as I'm sure you know, he set the bar quite high for virtual delivery. As you prepared for the contest, can you share with us how you formed your strategy for how you would engage the audience on camera?
So Mike Carr was my inspiration, watching the finals from last year and seeing what each of the contestants had done was absolutely incredible. But he really did, as you say, lift the bar as to what was possible on a virtual stage. And then for me, obviously, the bulk of the work that I went into the contest was my semi-final speech. So I played a lot with using different sides of the screen and coming into the camera. But all of that had been inspired by watching the contest the year before. There were choices there that I don't think I would have made if I hadn't seen what they'd done and the playfulness that the contestants brought. It was incredibly inspiring. So I don't think I would have given the same speech if I had been competing last year, to be honest.
As I think back to your delivery, as I watched it, it was almost like it was produced by a filmmaker. I mean, you were framed. So spot on with the use of the stage and with getting closer, backing off. It was just really well done.
Gosh, really thank you. I think it's probably my background in film and acting that has helped with the virtual space because I am used to working with a camera. But my sister is a casting director, so she also helped with some of the stage directions.
That makes sense because sometimes when you're watching TV or they're showing the filming of through the camera's lens, you see that square, you see the entire area that the camera lens sees, but then you see only the square where it's actually being recorded. We talked a little bit about your final speech. You also had a very powerful semi-final speech. And interestingly enough, the final speech spoke about your dad. The semi-final speech spoke about your mom. How did you choose which speech to give at the semi-final? Because there's some schools of thought that say, well, you need to give your best speech at the semi-final level, because if you don't get through the semi-final level, you'll never make it to the finals.
Sure. I didn't ever know about that school of thought. I'm quite glad I didn't know.
Some schools of thought. Not everyone might agree with that, though.
You know, for me, it was always going to be the order that I delivered it in. And my mum's speech, which actually was my level one icebreaker when I started the Pathways program last year, quite a different version of it at that time, I just had a sense that, wow, this could do well in a contest. And so I gave that speech everything I had for 6 months. And I just trusted that it was going to be strong enough to place in the semifinals. If I look back on it now, my dad's speech ended up being my strongest speech, but not for a long time. That took a lot of work for it to become the speech it did. But it was always that I would do mum first and then dad. So that was the way I chose it.
By the way, I don't know if there's any way we can verify this, but we do know that you're the first world champion from Africa. I wonder if you're the first world champion whose winning speech was actually their icebreaker speech. Like you said, it's evolved from then. But still, I wouldn't be surprised if that's a first. That's pretty amazing.
Yeah, maybe. It could be. It definitely could be. Who knows? That's quite fun.
There's quite a variety of speeches that we hear over the years. And many of them are a specific story or a time in someone's life or a vignette. But it seems that your entire past seems to have played a role in both your speeches. In trying to get to know you just a little bit better, I'm just going to preamble this with, I had no idea that before getting into speaking and facilitating, of course, until we did a little research on you, that you were a singer, a songwriter, and an actress. Now, interestingly enough, I felt that your speech, your delivery was very natural. It was very conversational in nature. And that's sort of to contrast the style of some of the other winners in the past. Some had props, like Mohamed Khatani had the cigarette and Darren Tay had the underwear and Manoj had the bow. You just decided to deliver it just purely from the heart and pretty conversational and in nature, not to take away from any of the other speeches. How did you decide to sort of leave that theatrical nature in mind and just deliver it the way you did?
You know, what's interesting for me is those deliveries, both my semifinals and my finals, are quite theatrical for me. So I think it's each speaker's got a different style. And one of the main reasons I haven't entered this contest for so many years was I didn't think that I could bring the level of theatrics, if you would, to the speech to be able to win. And perhaps because it went virtual, it gave me the place to play in that more natural. My natural style of acting as well allowed me to do that. For me, some of it felt quite big. I am naturally a very conversational speaker. I'm a keynote speaker, but I will have little moments of fun and drama in my speeches. So I just really spoke the way I speak, and I'm so grateful that it resonated this year and that it worked.
Verity, Greg just mentioned your background as a singer, songwriter, and actress. Can you tell us a little bit about that? And while you have pivoted, it sounds like career-wise, do you still do anything in those areas with those talents?
My singing is an interesting one because I wrote my first song on my 20th birthday while I was in my first year of university. And out of nowhere, I started songwriting. And at that point, I was someone who was deadly afraid of being on stage and speaking in front of people, let alone singing. But the more I wrote lyrics and the more I started coming up with songs to go with them, the more I realized I needed to find the courage to start singing. Ironically, it was actually my dad passing away when I was 24. That was the wake-up call that life is short and you don't want to get to the end of, well, I didn't want to get to the end of my life with a lot of regrets. And so I started slowly moving towards starting singing. It still took 3 years before I got on a stage at 27. But the more I got on stage, the more I sang about things that I believed in and messages that really meant something to me in my songs, the more my confidence developed. And I ended up living actually in America for a while. I was in Nashville, I was in Naples in Florida, and then I came back to South Africa and I worked with a band. But everything changed when I turned 30 and I started trying to raise the money to record my first album. And that was when I came up with an idea to ask people to buy an album I hadn't recorded. And without meaning to, I became one of the world's first online crowdfunders. And so instead of becoming famous for singing, I became very famous for thinking differently. And that was where my speaking career emerged. I was being invited to speak all over South Africa, all over Europe, and no one wanted my band. They just wanted me to talk about innovation and about how I came up with my idea. And so that's how my life changed. And for the last 10, 15 years, I have been sharing my story with people to inspire them as to how they can overcome the obstacles in their life. And I still sing at the end of a keynote. So the music hasn't totally gone.
At what point did you end up joining Toastmasters? How did that fit into your career as a speaker and facilitator?
I joined Toastmasters 10 years ago, and it was actually just to support my sister, Kay Price Lindsay, who had joined the year previously. And she was very nervous of speaking. She found it incredibly confronting, and she was using the program to build her confidence. And I joined for fun. I was already confident. I felt that I was actually quite accomplished as a speaker at that point. Little did I know how much I could still learn. And yeah, it's ended up being the most extraordinary journey for me, because most of my Toastmasters journey has been involved in the leadership side and serving my club, serving my division and my district. And that's what's really grown me as a person. And the speaking's always been on the side, but using the program to improve my humor, to improve the way I engage with an audience. And it's continuing to grow me, because I'm sure the next while ahead is going to have even more growth involved.
Verity, it sounds that you've caught the bug of your dad's optimism. And that leads me to my next question. And I'm curious, because some people seem to dwell on how life isn't, right? They go on, oh, this isn't how I thought my life would turn out. And I didn't think that I would be at this point in my life right now. And that actually blocks them from moving forward. You, on the other hand, sort of sees these crises as opportunities. Tell us a little bit about how you develop that, and how do you stay positive with that, especially when you have a situation where maybe things aren't as you expect them to be?
That continues to be a lifelong journey for me, Greg. It's actually one of the pieces of work I do in one of my keynotes on how to lead with optimism, and the positive psychology behind all of it is because this is something I struggle with. And what a lot of people don't know, but is a really interesting fact, is that when it comes to happiness, only 10% of it comes from our external circumstances. 50% is genetically predetermined, but 40% comes from the choices we make on a daily basis. The irony is we spend our whole lives often focusing 90% of our attention on external circumstances, wanting things to happen to us that will make us happy. But if we're not happy when they happen, we just go back to being unhappy. And so that has been my journey, because if you listen to my mom's semi-final speech, she struggled with alcoholism after my dad died. There was depression in my family. So I live with this interesting dance of a depressive nature at times and a very optimistic nature at other times from my dad. So every day I have to make a choice. I have to choose to be grateful. I have to choose to look at the glasses half full. And sometimes I have to actually just lie in bed, watch Netflix and eat ice cream. And that's also okay. I don't get it right all the time. It is a work in progress. But my dad definitely runs in my veins. And I'm always grateful when his attitude bubbles to the surface.
Netflix and ice cream. That's certainly a good thing. I am curious, when these thoughts come into your head, sort of those negative thoughts, do you actually transport yourself back in time and replay or relive some of the stories or some of the things that your mom and dad had gone through?
Sometimes it's just a feeling of heaviness, or life is feeling particularly difficult. And I've actually learned to try not to dwell on the story too much. That's the whole idea of writing a different story, is you can't keep telling an old story and hoping your life's going to change. So I will try and breathe into it. I will do something to nurture myself. I'll reach out and speak to a friend. I'll just do something that gets me into a positive mindset. And then I start telling a different story. The problem, I think, is when we dwell too long. And I certainly spent many years telling the story of the life I didn't want to be leading. And finding my dad's letter catapulted me into starting to realize the power of my own expression of my life. And everything I say is painting a picture that I'm walking into. So I should choose my words carefully.
That's very helpful.
Verity, I'd like to serve you up the opportunity to riff on one of a few different topics here. There's so much tied up in the content of your speech. So one might be the concept of reframing, of taking a situation that maybe seems negative and then flipping it on its head and finding a more empowering context to examine it. Another possible place you could go, if you might want to say a little bit more about the concept of intentionally authoring your life and how to really do that. And then finally, you mentioned positive psychology, and it brings to mind appraisal theory, this concept in psychology that we extract our emotions from the way we appraise or evaluate situations, things that happen to us. Any of those that you might want to say a few more words about or give us some practical tips on?
Absolutely. I think when it comes to reframing our story or a situation, it really comes down to listening to the words we're using to describe it. Our words have power. There's a thing called the explanatory theory. And some people have a positive explanatory style and they tend to do better in life. So people who speak about a difficult situation with a sense of hope, saying it's really hard, but I know it's going to get better, tend to get better results in business and in life than people who go, it's really hard, it's all ruined, it's never going to be okay. Because what that does is that does impact our emotions. As you're saying with appraisal theory, the way we're looking at something impacts the way we feel. Something as simple as just starting to practice daily gratitude and wake up and go, wow, I have a bed to lie on. Gosh, I've got electricity when I switch on the light. I mean, it's as simple as that. You know, I have a good friend I can phone. Wow, I've got airtime. I can phone someone. Like, you can keep finding things to be grateful for. But it's getting it into the habit. Just looking for three things you're grateful for every day for 21 days can boost your sense of optimism and well-being for a minimum of 3 months. So that's how you start to rewrite a story. And that was where my 100 happy days came in. I just took a picture every day of something that made me happy. I shared it on Facebook. And every time I shared that picture, it made me feel happy again. And it got me into a habit of happiness. And that's when life really starts to change, when these things become a habit because they become a daily choice.
By the way, you mentioned a moment ago the concept of the glass half full. I love the line in your speech, and I can't remember exactly what it is.
So he wasn't a glass half full guy. He was a, aren't I lucky I've got a glass guy.
Love it. Thank you.
But that is not my line, and I couldn't reference it because it was such a short little take, but it's from a beautiful book called The Boy, the Mole, the Horse, and the Fox, or The Boy, the Fox, the Mole, and the Horse. I can't remember the list of animals. But it's by Charles Mackesy, I think, an incredible illustrator from the UK. And it's a little scene in that book. That's where I got that inspiration of, aren't I lucky I've got a glass? I just love that.
Nice. That was great.
I'm going to have to go check that out.
Yeah, you will love it. It is the most beautiful book. And I follow him on Instagram because he has these animated drawings that come to life and they're just delightful.
Well, I think that we've confirmed that you are certainly the world champion of public speaking, because I'm not sure if it's an international term or not, but that last question that Ryan asked you was certainly a doozy.
You passed with flying colors.
Thank you.
I was thinking of perhaps trying to top that one, but I can't.
Well, I hope I answered it all right.
No, it was great. And I was thinking maybe I should take notes. But then again, I was thinking, no, we got the recording. I can go back and listen to this after the fact. Folks, if you enjoyed this podcast, please make sure that you share it with others. It's the best way for them to find out about the Toastmasters podcast, have them find out about Toastmasters, and of course, find a great way to connect with our special guest. You can get the podcast at toastmasterspodcast.com, at toastmasters.org, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and most of your other favorite outlets. Verity, as our time comes to an end, it's been a delightful conversation. If someone wants to find out a little bit more about you or connect with you, what's the best way that they could do that?
One of the easiest ways is to visit my website, iamverity.com or verityprice.com. Takes you to the same place. But I'm also loving sharing my journey with people on Instagram and Facebook at iamverity, or you can find me on LinkedIn, Verity Price.
Fantastic. Verity Price, once again, congratulations. Thank you for being on the show with us, and we wish you continued success.
Thank you.
Isn't it about time you published that book you've been thinking about? We can help with that. At ebookit.com, we've been providing authors and small presses with ebook publishing services since 2010. Visit us today at ebookit.com and let us know how we can help you.